Welcome to InVision Radio with Will Bowen. From Kansas City, the heart chakra of the United States. Take a few deep breaths and let's have some fun. Now, here's Will.
Thank you very much, Dan Murphy. Well, hello. Welcome to another episode of InVision Radio. I'm Will Bowen. I was thinking about comedian Bob Nelson the other day, who I once saw on an HBO special, gosh, 20 years ago. And he was making a parody of several nonprofit slogans, running them together. And he took the slogan at the time, which I think it still is, for the United Negro College Fund, and mashed it together with the American Cancer Society. And it came out, "Because the mind is a terrible thing, and we must stop it in our lifetime." Now, that was pretty funny, but in my mind, it was actually pretty profound as well. We all have this monkey mind, this chatter, this ego that goes on and on and on. And as I've said before, I believe it's a good thing. The reason I believe it's a good thing is that I don't believe that a benevolent deity would create anything that is not ultimately good. So that's my theology coming in there, but that's what I truly believe. So if that's the case, then why do we have this onboard bully that is in our brains that tells us we can't do things, we're no good? You know, I was reading Think and Grow Rich the other day, and Napoleon Hill was talking about, he listed all the things that his ego was saying as to why the book he was working on, which ultimately became the biggest self-help book of all time, wouldn't work, why nobody would care, why it wouldn't come together. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting, because I have one of those thought patterns in my head. I was sitting on the couch last night after the family went to bed, and I have this project that you're going to be hearing about that I am really excited about, and yet my mind tells me all the reasons it won't work, why it's a bad idea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I believe that this bully is there basically to cause us to be bigger and stronger. I don't want to go too far with a bully metaphor, but certainly when I was a kid, you would see in movies of a bully picking on another kid. The kid goes and they work out and everything. The bully comes after them and they trounce the bully. Well, in your ego's case, sometimes we trounce the ego. Sometimes we talk it down. Sometimes we challenge it. But whatever it takes, it verifies for us and it clarifies for us our position and our strength. So I believe that the ego is a good thing. It's a difficult thing. It's a challenging thing. Just like pain is a good thing. I say that because, I mean, if we had no pain, you'd put your hand on a hot stove. You would just burn up. We need pain to protect us. And I think we need the ego to make us stronger. The challenge, I think, for so many people is that they just succumb to the ego. They believe that the ego is them. And so they don't really try. They try and they fail, which everyone does many times. But then their egos tell them that for some reason they can't succeed or that they are no good, and they believe it. Well, I'm talking about all of this because I want to call this our Nevermind show. That is, never let your mind stop you from doing something. So we're going to be talking tonight about how to capture our egos. Not necessarily restrain it, but at least identify it and also begin to challenge it and work with it so that we become stronger in the process. With me is Dr. Lisa Firestone. She's going to be talking about her book, How to Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, which I can tell you, I have a copy and it is so dog-eared. I've used it as a workbook. It's a phenomenal book and I quote it several times in my book, Happy This Year. So it's a real treat to have Lisa with us tonight. And also in the Namaste Lounge is Daniel Namod. Daniel Namod is a true singer-songwriter who is elevating the consciousness of the world, and he does it in such a beautiful way. Not only are songs beautiful, but they are they're very real. They are they're in keeping with what every one of us feels. And they're truly beautiful. So later on in the Namaste Lounge, we'll have Daniel Namod. I want to share with you a To You Love God that I wrote. To You Love God is a series of emails that I began several years ago. They continue to go out as emails. Nowadays, mostly they're read on Facebook, and we do have a book that will be coming out later this year, To You Love God. I'll be telling you more about that. It'll be out in December of 2014. Here's one I wrote recently. A hummingbird buzzes from place to place. It flits here, darts there, and then zips off somewhere else. This tiny aerial acrobat seems random and chaotic in its actions. Yet there's nothing haphazard about this brilliant little bird. It follows its instincts, doing what it must to assure its survival. Frenetic activity is typically all that you see in the flight of the hummingbird. Yet this vibrant creature can sit quietly for long stretches. When it isn't feeding, it rests at one with its surroundings. You, in your hectic activities, are like the hummingbird. But unlike the hummingbird, you dart about even when it is not necessary. You don't stop and savor the life you are living. Your busyness increases your adrenaline level, causing you to hurry all the more. It also brings on stress, releasing endorphins. In short, you get a rush from rushing. The rush of rushing masks the joy of living. Take a few moments right now to gaze about, drink in your life, feel gratitude for what you have. If even for just this moment, peace, be still. Love God. I once saw an interview with the actress Rebecca De Mornay, and she was learning to meditate, and she said that her guru said, "Don't just do something, sit there." Boy, when things are going crazy in our lives, we get pumped up, we get this rush of rushing, and we feel like we have to keep going 24 hours a day, and oftentimes the best thing we can do is nothing. Just sit, take a breath or 12, and begin to feel better. And once we're centered, then we move forward. Check in with yourself. See if you find yourself rushing to get a rush. Well, in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing to you Dr. Lisa Firestone. You're going to hear more about how to conquer your critical inner voice, and later on in the Namaste Lounge, where singers and songwriters share their muse, their music, and their musings, Daniel Namod. Hang around. We're going to have some fun. We want to be young enough to say, oh, this has got to be the good life. This has got to be the good life. This could really be the good life, good life. I say, oh, this feeling that you can't fight. The city is a fight. What if you could get inside the heads of 50 of the happiest people alive? What if you could hear their stories, learn how they overcame life's challenges, and discover their secrets to happiness? This is Happy Stories by Will Bowen. In Happy Stories, you'll meet parents, business people and entrepreneurs, students, retirees and construction workers, school principals, stay-at-home moms, and more who have one thing in common. They have discovered how to be happy, regardless of what life throws their way. Happy people hang around with other happy people as a way of staying happy. Read Happy Stories, and it's like having 50 very happy people with you at all times. Happy Stories by Will Bowen, available in print, ebook, and audiobook, read by the author. Happy Stories from Grand Harbor Press. Read these happy stories now, and your life will become a happy story as well.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy, crazy.
Welcome back to Envision Radio. I'm Will Bowen. Well, I'm very excited about my next guest, and I want to give you a little introduction for her. Dr. Lisa Firestone is the Director of Research and Education at the Glendon Association and Senior Editor of PsychAlive.org. That's PsychAlive. She's the author of several books, including Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, as well as Creating a Life of Meaning and Compassion, and most recently, The Self Under Siege. Dr. Firestone is a regular blogger on Psychology Today and Huffington Post. She is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Santa Barbara, California. You can learn more about her at psychalive.org and glendon.org. Don't worry if those went by you quickly. I'll spell them for you later. Lisa, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm glad to do this with you.
I'm so glad you're here. I am so glad you're here because I'm so glad you wrote this book. I want to give a little preface about this book. I honestly don't know where I found your book, except I think I was cruising Amazon one day and specifically looking for things about your critical inner voice. It was as if I was led to your book because this idea of this ongoing running criticism that runs in so many of our heads is a struggle for so many people. Bought this book, Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, and it is not just a book, it is a workbook. It takes you through specific steps of things you can do to identify as well as to conquer and move past your critical inner voice. It is a wonderful book. I have my copy here in my hand. I'm thumbing through it, and it is, let's see, I see two different colors of highlight. I see pens marking, pages turned down. That is the way for a book to be used, in my opinion. So, Lisa, it's a wonderful book. Congratulations. Would you introduce and tell us about the rest of your team who participated in this particular book?
Sure. I wrote the book with my colleague Joyce Catlett, and her and I have been working together for a lot of years doing presentations and writing, and are actually going to be doing a workshop at Esalen on Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice, and we do that every year. And then the other person that I wrote the book with is my father, Dr. Robert Firestone, and it's really based around his theoretical perspective. And, you know, he's written a lot of books for professionals, but we really wanted to bring this to everybody and make it something that everybody could use, and like you said, a workbook to really work through this process of getting free from these critical inner voices.
What do you feel is the source of the critical inner voice?
Well, I really think that it starts in early childhood experiences, and, you know, particularly those with the people we care, you know, have the most influence on us, our primary caretakers, but also others as well, you know, siblings that teased us. We all know that peers can be cruel when you're growing up. So it's not only parents, but certainly other people who are significant in our lives. And it's not only with parents, things they actually said or did to us, it's ways they felt about themselves.
Oh, wait a minute. Would you say that again, please? That is so important because we tend to think that it is the way the parents treat us, but you feel it's more energetically or how they've modeled their own feelings about themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, because one of the things we found in a 30-year longitudinal study we've been doing is that the negative thoughts people have are very similar from one generation to the next within a family, sort of those core negative thoughts, you know, those really deep ones. And it's often the way a parent felt about themselves, and then the child picks it up like it's true about themselves. And, you know, the take-home message to parents is you really need to work on feeling good about yourself, that, you know, just letting yourself indulge in self-hatred or self-criticism is really a bad strategy for being a good parent.
Again, a wonderful choice of the word, indulge, because that is often what happens, that when we find ourselves getting into a bit of a negative spiral, as Eckhart Tolle says, when our pain body gets activated, it stimulates us and tends to then grow on itself. And it is an indulgence,
right?
Wouldn't you feel?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, you know, what the book helps you do is start to recognize when you're in that pattern and at least say to yourself, I'm attacking myself right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you get some distance from it. And then really starting to take actions that go against these negative thoughts rather than feeding them in a way or making them stronger by acting on them.
Lisa Firestone is my guest. Lisa, do you feel that everyone has this critical inner voice to some degree?
Absolutely. You know, we were doing, Joyce and I were doing a radio show a number of years ago when a beauty pageant was going on, and, you know, they interviewed us for the radio saying, you know, don't these beauty pageants make young girls feel terrible about themselves? And we talked a little bit about the critical inner voices that can get triggered by those things. But then, you know, they were saying, but the beauty pageant contestants, they don't have any critical inner voices. And we were like, well, we bet they do. Why don't you go ask them? And they did. And it was really striking because, you know, here are these very attractive, you know, objectively and, you know, very accomplished girls, because they had to be academically accomplished to get into the competition as well.
As well as have talent and other things as well, right?
Right.
Okay.
And they had all that going for them, and they had critical inner voices, too. So we often think it's just because we're stupid or we're ugly or whatever it might be that we tell ourselves that we have these thoughts. You know, mine are really true. You know, other people might have thoughts. But, you know.
That's an important distinction. I'm sorry. That is such a great distinction, too, is that for some reason, I mean, I'm sitting here. My thought is, you mean Lisa Firestone has a critical inner voice? And then I think, yeah, but hers is just nonsense. Mine's the real deal.
Right, see? Yeah, we do all have them.
Wow. Now, do you see a distinction between, and you may not be aware of this concept, I think you are, but what people nowadays call the ego, which is not in the Freudian sense, but in the metaphysical, spiritual sense, that the critical inner voice inside. Do you see that as being the same thing?
No, I at least I think of the ego as being more like our real self, or, you know, we make a real big distinction between what we would call our real self, the real things that interest us, that light us up, that really give our life meaning, and then what we would call like an anti-self, or a part of us that's turned against ourselves. And the critical inner voice is kind of the language of that anti-self, both warning us not to take chances, making us feel indignant if people quote to insult us, you know, lashing out at us when we try new things, telling us that we're just going to fail. So, you know, the anti-self has different parts. It's a way of self-parenting where you're telling yourself both warning and protective things, but that get in the way of you really getting what you want, and also negative things that make you feel like you can't go after what you want.
Wow. I can think of maybe five great epiphanies I've had in my life in sort of trying to figure myself out and move my life in the direction I want to take it. And one of those epiphanies, I would have to say without unreservedly, is this concept that you talk about of the fantasy bond in the book. Can you explain that?
Sure. I think the fantasy bond is a really important concept and a little bit of a hard one for people to get their minds around. But it's the idea that in starting the self-parenting process from the beginning, when we form a fantasy or an illusion of connection to our parent very early on during moments of stress, where we start to parent ourselves, both punishing ourselves and nurturing ourselves much as we were treated early in life. And then when we become adults and get into romantic relationships, we tend to extend this into our relationships where we look for that person to save us, if you will, you know, to protect us from everything. And in that, we form a fantasy bond or an illusion of connection with that other person, a merged identity, where we actually start to give up points of identity and not feel like a separate, independent, whole person on our own. And once we do that, the real quality of the relating between two people deteriorates. The real acts of love and kindness and really even seeing the other person clearly.
It sounds to me like you're talking about codependence. I mean, that this is the launching pad for a codependent relationship.
Absolutely. And we're very much using that person to feel like a whole person and forgetting that we're a whole person on our own.
Mm.
And, you know, so we have this sort of fused identity, but we're not now treating each other. So we may have a fantasy that we're still in love, but if somebody was observing us from the outside, they probably wouldn't see much of our behavior as loving.
Okay. Well, in one of the things that you talk about in the fantasy bond, and I'm gonna paraphrase you and you correct me. How's that?
Okay, no problem.
Okay, here we go. One of the things that really struck me was that when we are children, our parents are, for lack of a better term, God. We have no concept of God outside of our parents, and our parents give for us, do everything for us. Then we have to live in an ordered universe. We have to live in a universe where we believe that there is a divine, not necessarily a divine plan, but that there's justice. And so when that parent, who very likely was an abused child themselves, carries that forward, and then they see us as their child. Well, if they see themselves as bad, as deficient in some way, their children, must also be bad and deficient. So they treat their children that way. They then grow up thinking, well, God can't be wrong. If the parent is God and God can't be wrong, then therefore, if the parent is upset with me, the problem is me. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I also, you know, I mean, if you, the way I would, you know, sort of say it is this, that, you know, we are totally dependent on our parents when we're young children. We can't do anything for ourselves. I have a sister just has a small baby who was born the beginning of December. So, you know, I mean, they're totally, completely dependent. So that feels a lot like, you know, they're God.
Mm-hmm.
Because our life is really in their hands. And it's actually too scary to the child to think that their parent might be deficient, because that means that this is hopeless. I'm never going to get loved, or I'm never going to get the things I need because this person doesn't have them to give. Now, that's a very scary idea when we're a young child. It's much better to think that, oh, I'm a bad kid, and if I just be good, then my parent will love me.
Isn't that amazing? I'm sorry, I have to stop you right there. Okay, it's better for the child to say, okay, I'm not good. Isn't that amazing?
Right, because that gives them some hope. It puts the
right
control in their hands. Because then if I just change, if I just do it right, then they'll love me.
If I'm good enough.
Yeah, if I'm good enough. And the reality is that a lot of parents who didn't get enough emotional sustenance when they were growing up turn to their children with emotional hunger. And that drains the child instead of feeds the child. And, you know, so that doesn't leave them with much to give. And especially if we have unresolved trauma and loss, we now know that when that gets triggered in our brain, which it will by our children, that it tends to make us flip our lid and basically engage in behavior that we wouldn't when we had full use of the higher functions of our mind.
So we resort to being the dark side of what we received as parenting.
Right, because we're in that triggered emotional state. We may actually even be experiencing a flashback to some abusive experience that we had without really knowing it. It doesn't feel like you're remembering when implicit memories get triggered. It just feels like you're back in the bad situation.
Yeah.
So you may feel like your parent, your child is your persecuting parent, you know, and then you feel justified to act back on the child. And that's where a lot of bad behavior happens, is in those, quote, flip-lid moments. And this comes from the work of Dan Siegel and interpersonal neurobiology, but understanding what's going on in our brain, I think, helps us to understand those moments when we lose it with somebody and act in ways that we wouldn't approve of.
Awareness is the first step to mastery. Is that what you're saying? I mean, we've got to be aware that we're
Absolutely.
Doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Lisa Firestone please.
And we have to feel the full pain of our childhoods and make sense out of it in order to really get free from it. So that's part of understanding the critical inner voices, is what were the things that really did hurt us when we were children, and, you know, can we recognize those, feel the pain of it, and make sense out of it?
Well, there then is an important distinction, because in my opinion, and I used to have a person I worked with who was a therapist. And I don't mean she worked as my therapist. We worked in a business together, and she was also a therapist. But the point I'm trying
right.
to make is that she worked with people to bring up their pain and everything. But from my perspective, when she would talk, she would never talk specifics, but it seemed like she kept them in their pain. So isn't there a fine line between bringing up the pain, feeling it so that it can be integrated, and yet not continuing to stir it up and allow it to feed the fantasy bond of your being bad?
Right. So it's feeling the pain in the context of really understanding it and making sense out of it. So you can make a coherent narrative about your life that makes sense, you know. It's not so you stay stuck. Staying stuck in the pain is still sort of believing that if I'm good, then, somehow I'll get the loving, nurturing, all these things that I didn't get. So it's partly having to make peace with that you don't need those things anymore as an adult.
Wow.
And that's part of what we talk about in our book, Self Under Siege, where we're talking about differentiating from our past. It's understanding the critical inner voices. It's also looking at things we incorporated from our parents early on in terms of their negative traits that we may be living out in our relationships today. And also looking at adaptations we made that were the best adaptation we could as a child in that social environment of our family, but that aren't working for us today in our relationships, and really changing those. So, you know, that's really moving beyond the pain and making sense out of it. And then really, you know, developing a life that's guided by what really matters to you and what really gives your life meaning, so you can have a really satisfying, meaningful life.
Lisa Firestone is my guest. We're talking about the book Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice. And what I like about the book, too, is that you don't just talk about this in an abstract way. You go into relationships, you go into workplace, you go into parenting. You even talk about how it shows up in sex, in every area of your life. So the first step is to acknowledge that you have this critical inner voice in some ways to disassociate from it, to feel the pain of the fantasy bond. Can you give us some practical steps for conquering the critical inner voice? I'm sure that's what everybody wants to know. Okay, well, yes. Now, how do I do it?
Right. Well, I think the first step, like you said, is recognizing it. So becoming aware of times that you're attacking yourself. And we actually have people journal about it. And it's one of the things they can do on our website, Psych Alive. We have a journal. And it's, you know, we can't see it. It's totally got a firewall between us. And it's your private journal. And you can password it so people who get on your computer, like your kids or your spouse, can't see it either. But it's journaling about it, getting it out there. Because what we find is when we keep it in our head, it seems more real. Seeing it out in black and white and paper or on our computer screen or saying it out loud to somebody really helps us start to get some perspective on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people say it in a particular way, in the second person, as though they were another person talking to themselves. We do this because that also helps you get some separation from it. And
can you give an example? Can you give an example, especially when you say second person? Because one of the things that you do bring up is that, if I recall, the critical inner voice will often speak in the first person. Is that right? In your opinion?
It's often like, you know, you're this. You're
okay,
that.
So that's second person then.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So instead of I'm stupid, I'm no good, I'm a failure, it's you're stupid, you're no good,
right.
You're a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives you some separation from it. It also tends to take on a life of its own when you say it that way, where you start off with things that you're very aware of on the surface, but what comes out are some more deep core beliefs about yourself. And that's really important because that's kind of like getting to the root of the problem instead
mm-hmm.
of just the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, you know, and then it's really looking at what actions are you taking in your life today that are based on that way of thinking, and what actions would you take if you were really on your own side. So a metaphor I like to give people, sort of like...
I hate to keep interrupting you. You say such good stuff. I'm going to interrupt you every time you do. You're on your own side. I just love that, because in so many ways, so often, we are not on our own side.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Our worst enemy.
Thank you. I just love that. You're on your own side. Okay. So okay. Please continue.
So, if you think of this critical inner voice as an enemy that lives inside of you, has access to all of your intelligence and all of your experiences.
Right.
And every time you give into it and go with the negative thought in terms of your behavior, you're kind of feeding the monster. It gets stronger and stronger, takes more and more control over your life. And what you want to do is basically starve the monster. So, you know, initially, your critical inner voice is not going to be happy. It's going to yell and scream, almost like a parent yelling at you to get you back into line.
Mm-hmm.
How dare you try to do that?
Mm-hmm. You know,
you're just going to fail. But if you keep with the behavior, it actually fades into the background, kind of like a parent that gets tired of nagging. And it really shrinks the critical inner voice. So you want to give it less control over your life, less, you know, take up less room in your head. So you want to systematically act against it. You also want to understand...
Let me stop you just a moment.
Sure.
Give an example of systematically acting against it. So in other words, the critical inner voice says, and then you respond. Would you mind?
Right. So let's say you want a new job or you are looking for a job. That's the case for a lot of people today. And you're telling yourself things like nobody would hire somebody like you. You're never going to get to do what you want. You know, you should just stay at this job, or you should give up altogether and just stay home. You know, if you give into it, you're not going to get anywhere. So you want to start to take actions that go against it. So a first action might be something like putting together your resume. Again, initially it's going to get louder, screaming and yelling. You're going to feel anxious.
Yes.
But you just keep going. You take the next step, which is sending out your resume. First 100 times doesn't work. You might have to do a second 100 times. You might have to look at other avenues for getting it out there. You might need to talk to friends and family and people and let them know what you're looking for, even though that can feel embarrassing, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking for a new job and having trouble finding one, you know, admitting that can look, you know, be hard. But taking those steps just systematically going against the critical inner voices that come up, recognizing them. So you send out your resume. What voices came up? What does it want you to do? It wants you to back off. It wants you to, you know, stay home and crawl under the covers and not try. You know, you tell the first person.
Let me ask you a question. Why does it want you to stay home and back off? Because it is you. Does it want to stay home because therefore it then gains control? In other words, the less you do, the worse you feel about itself, about yourself.
And the more isolated you are, the more control it has.
The more right it is. Beautiful.
Right. And the more you're around people who care about you, the harder it is for this voice to gain control of your behavior. The more you're around people that support you. So it's also another systematic step you can take is identifying people in your immediate social circle who are allies in this change process and ones who are actually potentially toxic. And it's hard because sometimes people you really care about or close family members are toxic to your change process. And so, but identifying that really matters because you want to build a support team of people who are actually going to help you to move towards your goals, who are going to be supportive of you finding those things that are meaningful to you in your life. Because sometimes those things don't fit in with the status quo of what your family wanted for you or even what your spouse may want for you.
Well, sometimes it's darned inconvenient to them. What do you mean you want to, my fiance, she actually quit her job as a deputy juvenile officer and became a yoga teacher and is thrilled now, but there was years of struggle. And so it was inconvenient to her family because she no longer did it the way they wanted.
Right. And it didn't fit maybe what they wanted to be able to tell people about what their daughter
right,
did.
Yes.
But it gave her life more meaning, you know, and she's more fulfilled every day. Isn't that more important?
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you have to take your own side. And that, I think, is really important. And go for the things that are going to give your life meaning. You know, you don't, you know, we have, you know, a limited amount of time in life, and it's really important to pursue the things that give us meaning, because what we found is that, you know, people who try to just pursue happiness don't get very far. But if you pursue meaning and things that really matter to you, guess what? You get happy as a side effect.
Well, it's kind of funny because my new book, Happy This Year, of course, and in that book, I quote you and your colleagues several times and talk a lot about you, but there is a lot of focusing on this idea that if you're not on some kind of purpose, if you don't have a reason in your life, and it can't be getting money or looking good. It's got to be something that's making you feel fulfilled and helping other people, then you'll never be happy.
Right. And that helping other people piece is a big piece too, because we now know that generosity is really a mental health principle, not just a, you know, religious or moral principle, because it really does make you feel better. It makes you live longer. You know, it contributes more to your happiness. And, you know, and I actually saw this thing the other day of, you know, you should be doing at least an hour every week of doing something for others if you want to feel happy.
I'm just sitting here thinking it's, I had something stressful occur yesterday myself, and then it was rather stressful, a couple of things. And I have to be honest, I was struggling to feel happy, and then I got a call that someone was in intensive care and maybe passing on, and I went and spent the evening with the family. And my problems didn't matter at all anymore. And it wasn't, I really don't feel that it was because I was comparing them alongside the fact that this woman was making her life's transition. I think it was because I was there purely to give.
Mm-hmm.
That's so
Absolutely.
Important. Yeah.
It is so important. It will get you out of a funk every time.
Well, now, Lisa,
you know,
go ahead, please.
And I think that's such an important thing that, you know, finding some place or way to volunteer or do something where you're giving to others is just so important.
The book is Conquer Your Critical Inner Voice. You have two other books that have come out as well, Creating a Life of Meaning and Compassion, as well as The Self Under Siege. You can reach Dr. Lisa Firestone at www.psychalive.org. That's psychalive.org, as well as www.glendon.org. You can find information about retreats. You can go and spend time with her and her colleagues doing intensive work. And as we said, you are a practicing therapist there in California. Lisa, thank you so much. I love your work, and I so admire what you've done, not only for my own life, but for so many people. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Can I just mention our e-course, too? We're doing a new
Please
e-course
do.
Online.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. We're doing one on creating your ideal relationship, and that's going to be on Psych Alive. You know, it's going to be a six-week course where we'll be sending the materials, doing live Q&As, webinars, and a whole series of things. So this is a new venture for us.
Well, that is wonderful, and I think it's so great that we live in a day and time when people like you can share your gifts and talents with people anywhere.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, that is so great. Once again, the web address is psychalive.org and also glendon.org, G-L-E-N-D-O-N. Check out Lisa Firestone. And thank you very much. Stick around. We've got more fun stuff coming up right after this.
Maybe I need a straight jacket, face facts. I am nuts for real, but I'm okay with that. It's nothing. I'm still friends with
the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me. Stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy. Yeah, you think I'm crazy.
International Health Partners has completed three major projects in Tanzania. Now our project is to build the first pediatric hospital there. 18 million children in Tanzania under age 14 have no pediatric hospital to serve them. At Zinga, on the coast north of Dar es Salaam, we have begun by starting the outpatient unit. We invite you to help. Visit our website, ihptz.org. Find out who we are and what we do, and contribute by clicking on Just Give or call 480-540-9317 and make a credit card donation. Your money will help build the first pediatric facility, and care for children under 5 years old will be free. You'll receive information on how each dollar was spent, pictures of what's going on at the facility, and we do not sell our donors' names and addresses to anyone. So go online now to ihptz.org. It's an act of love and caring, and it will help to change the world, one child at a time.
When things go wrong, it's natural to wonder, what celestial rule did I break? When things go right, it's logical to ponder, what credit can I take? But the truth is so much easier. I don't need a master plan. I can live here in the moment, 'cause my life is in good hands. I don't need to know where the wind blows, 'cause God knows.
Welcome to the Namaste Lounge, where singers and songwriters who are making the world a brighter place share their music, their muse, and their musings. My guest today is Daniel Namah. Daniel is a Los Angeles-based singer, songwriter, and humanitarian who has performed his profound, heart-opening original music for over 1 million people in 45 U.S. states and Canada. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Will.
It's so great to have you. I always like to, if I can, tell a little story about the people that I'm interviewing. So I'm going to tell a little story about you.
Okay.
The last time I think I actually saw you perform was at the Agape International Center at Michael Beckwith's place. And you were performing, and it was one of, well, this is typical for Michael's church, but it was just, the energy in there was so high and everybody was so up, and Ricky and the band had performed and everything. And then they introduced you and you came out and you did something I've never seen another artist do. And that is, you came out and you sat for a moment and you just sat and you centered yourself. And that was such a beautiful, prayerful moment. In that moment, to me, you didn't get caught up in the excitement and the enthusiasm of people seeing you. You connected to God, which is what your music does better than most of the music I've ever heard. So I just want to say that that was a profound moment for you. For me, rather.
That's really nice of you to say, and thanks for noticing. That's kind of exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, that is so wonderful. Well, we opened the segment with I Don't Need to Know from your album One Power. This is a powerful song about releasing control. It seems that only when we let go of trying to make things happen, we can let God do for us. Is that the message behind the song for you?
Yeah, I'd say so, absolutely.
Yeah. What was your inspiration for writing this song?
That is a great question. You know, it's funny, I've been singing on that theme ever since I wrote that song. You know, I joke that that song took me about 10 years to understand after I wrote it. and I'm not even sure I still do in terms of, certainly haven't mastered the idea that I don't need to hold on to the steering wheel quite so tightly or control everything or maintain the illusion of control is really what it is, for things to turn out fine and for me to be okay. There's a line in another song of mine, "I'm okay, I've always been, and I'll always be that way." That's a tough thing to learn. You know, I've been traveling for 10, 15 years, and every time you go through an airport, through, you know, TSA security, God bless them, they're doing a brilliant job, but mm-hmm. there's a whole earthly definition of safety that a song like "I Don't Need to Know" is really not about. It's about a different kind of safe. There's a line, actually, the sneakiest line in "I Don't Need to Know" is, "The minute I surrender, I'm as safe as I can be."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tricky thing to wrap your head around.
Well, and it's a constant dance too, because there is this human side of us that wants to endure, that wants to live on, that, and we tend to,
right.
Our egos will tell us, well, it has to do with success, it has to do with making things happen, but that is just more and more defining ourselves as the thing we are not, which is this physical form.
Right, the earthly stuff, right.
Yeah. And so you're suggesting we just need to release and to turn it over to God.
Yeah, way easier said than done. But
isn't
yes.
it though? Yeah.
Yes, it really is. You know, I've got the. We talked a little bit before that I have a little boy now.
Yeah.
And
dude.
I'll tell you, I have never felt more attached, you know, to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of an open hypocrite on the subject of non-attachment, non-control. I would do anything to keep his little body safe, even as I know that there's a fundamental, real sense in which it's not my job.
Yeah.
You know, I can only do what I can do.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard concept. My mother used to always say to me that God has no grandchildren. God has only children.
That's a beautiful phrase. Yeah.
Well, I love that. And it's so true, because so often we think this is my child. But then again, we're coming from the ego and identifying with the child as opposed to saying this is God's child and I'm here to shepherd and here to love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just to love. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Let me play a little bit of another song of yours. This is off of your CD, Water. Isn't there a story, if I recall, Daniel, did you not sequester yourself away as you wrote this song? I seem like I heard this from someone who told me, and I wasn't sure I ever got the straight dope from you.
Yeah, that's actually just what I was talking about I Don't Need to Know, that since writing that song, that's kind of become a predominant theme. In more than just my music, really, in my life, is being like water. That song is from an album called Water,
mm-hmm.
which I mention only because the songs are all about trusting and surrendering, and as one of the songs is titled, "Going Where the Ocean Says to Go." And that's so last song is kind of the ultimate song for me about surrender. Right. If this is my last song, what's important? What has turned out to be important, and what have I left as a legacy, if anything? I've hosted some retreats. The sequester you mentioned was in Moab, Utah, a little town in southeastern Utah, where I spent 3 months pretty much on my own. Although I went in town for chocolate frozen yogurt and and groceries, but mostly
you've got to have the necessities.
Own.
You've got to have
correct,
the necessities.
Correct. It's the basic. It's like water or electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hike and lay out under the stars and sit in silence. And I've never heard quiet like I heard in the wintertime in Red Rock Country in the high desert. Absolutely breathtakingly beautiful. No description could suit it. I wrote 125 songs during those 3 months, and
say that again. That's a song a day, Daniel. That's pretty amazing.
No.
Yeah.
Some days were 5 or 6 songs.
Wow.
And I got a little lazier as it went on.
Still, that's pretty impressive. So
yeah,
you did.
Well,
you went away, and
it's not impressive if you heard most of the songs. Most of them aren't very good.
Well, I tell you what, the songs on Water are terrific. Before we get too much into this song, let me play a little snippet of it.
Is the world a little more peaceful? Oceans and sky a little more blue? is humankind a little bit wiser about the good that we can do? Does the sun shine a little bit brighter where before there was only rain? If so, then I'm glad I came.
Daniel Namot is my guest, and that was his song titled Last Song from his CD Water. It seems to be a song about creating a legacy, but one of real substance. Is that what you're trying to present in this song?
In a way, it's a legacy of substance, but in a way, it's also about modest expectations. You know, if you set out to win a Nobel Prize, or heal the world of its poverty or suffering or war, I think you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of frustration. And I would also say that if I have the aspiration to win a Nobel Peace Prize, that's probably more about pride than about service.
Right.
Whereas if I do what I can do for the person right in front of me, even anonymously, that might be the highest possible service. So the song is about a legacy, but it's also about reeling in ego and attachment. As I sometimes say when I'm talking about the water songs, yesterday is done, tomorrow is none of my business, and today I have all that I need.
Beautiful.
So is there really a guarantee that I'll be remembered, or how I'll be remembered, and why do I care, right? If I've made one person smile today, what if that's enough? What happens to my pride and ego? How much less do I sweat? How much better do I sleep, right? How much more loving am I? If it doesn't matter whether there are after effects or reverberations, whether I just do the best I can do today and let that be. Right. That's really ultimately what it's about.
It's not about how long our Wikipedia entry is after we die or whatever. It's about truly the people we're impacting right now. As Marilyn Williamson says, your address book is your ministry. The people in your life, we seek to want to do these huge, grandiose things, and yet the people in our lives are the people that we really have the most impact and the most chance to touch. And that's what this song seems to be encouraging us to do. I love this song. I remember when I got this CD, I got it from you, listened to it, and that song just, wow, really touched me. Speaking of wows, let's talk about a collaboration that you have done. I will invite people to actually go and listen to this song on YouTube. And the song is titled Grateful, and it's by Daniel and his collaborator friend Nemo. Tell us about the song Grateful and the video that's on YouTube.
Yeah, thanks. You know what? It's a pretty wild story. Nemo is an Indian hip hop artist, and I wouldn't have known that existed, but there it is. He succeeded. He had a hit song. He's renowned in the Indian hip hop world, which is a world that exists, as I said. Mm-hmm. And had a hit song, and then had a sort of a spiritual epiphany that he didn't feel like he was, like that was enough of a contribution to humanity. He's in his 30s. He's a super sweet guy. I had never heard of him or heard his music, but he decided to, speaking of sequester himself at the ashram where Gandhi lived.
Wow.
And for 2 years he went and lived at Gandhi's ashram in India. And during those 2 years, as it turns out, on his way to the airport, he's American and Indian, so he was at the Oakland airport on his way to the Gandhi ashram for 2 years, and a friend of his handed him what he called an obscure CD from a singer-songwriter he'd never heard. And for the next 2 years, he listened to no music except the Water CD by Daniel Namot. And I wouldn't have known this except that he talked about it in an interview afterwards when he had started a foundation that literally saved the lives of 16 children who were living on the streets in India.
Wow.
Started a school, basically, for these 16 kids and their families to teach them job skills, academic, arts, and a daily act of kindness. Not making any of this up.
Wow. He's
really that impressed the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward a couple of years, and now when he comes to the States to visit, he still lives at the Gandhi Ashram, and when he comes to the States to visit, he comes to my recording studio in Orange County, and he sparked the idea of writing a song about gratitude. So the song Grateful was a collaboration between him in India, me in Orange County, And if you watch the video, you'll see people literally from all over the world singing that song with us, who all sent in clips of themselves as a gift. The video was edited as a donation by obviously very professional video editing people. It's a beautiful video. I had nothing to do with it.
That's what I was going to say, is that when you guided me to look at this, I was just blown away by the production value in this. And I said, Daniel, off the air, this must have cost a lot of money. And you said, no, it cost nothing.
Nothing. Not a penny. And we've had, I think, between YouTube and KarmaTube, I know we've had more than 200,000 people watch this video. We've gotten feedback from all over the world, just people showing this video to their preschool classes and people watching this video every day as they are passing away. And we've just gotten incredible, beautiful feedback. It's really a very special thing, and it's really inspired by Nemo. So I wrote the chorus. He wrote the rap. And we produced it in my studio collaboratively, like I said, across the world. And it came out beautifully. It really did. Proud of it.
If humankind's a little bit kinder by the things that we do, I think you're having a wonderful impact on our world, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Nice to hear you say. Yeah, thanks, Will.
Wow. How can people get in contact with you? Now, it's danielnahmod.com. That's correct, isn't it?
Right. NAHMOD.com. Although I'm touring a lot less lately. I mentioned my recording studio. I've shifted into producing quite a bit more lately. I've produced probably 10 or 15 records in the last 3 years, but only one of them is my own. They're all other artists, and I'm really, really hitting a stride on that. I really enjoy making other people's musical visions reality, and I'm on tour a little bit, but much less. Mostly hanging out in Southern California, spending time with my wife and beautiful baby Jude.
Wow, sounds to me like you've hit a groove.
Yeah, really have. Thanks.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, Daniel Nahmod, thank you so much. I invite you to please check out danielnahmod.com. It's spelled like Nahmod, N-A-H-M-O-D, but it's Nay.
Correct.
danielnahmod.com, and also go to KarmaTube or go to YouTube and watch Grateful. It's a wonderful song. It's certainly something you're going to want to share. Daniel, thank you so much, and namaste.
Pleasure, Will. Thank you so much.
Whoever we think. Wherever we think we're headed, whatever we're going through right now, there's a truth behind it all, about the stuff we're really made of. And that greatest truth of all is that in His image God has made us. And if that's true, just think about what it says for me and you. God is light, and so are we.
God is everything light, happens for a reason.
And so are we. God is life, and so
it is no accident that you are here at this very moment listening to this very program. Now, back to Will.
Thanks, Dan. Daniel's music just always puts me into a state, you know, that wonderful spiritual state where you just feel connected to God and you just don't feel attached to issues and challenges in life. Daniel Nahmod, I highly recommend his music. Look him up on iTunes. Well, this is our Nevermind show, working to never mind the mind that we have, the ego that we have. I made a realization not long ago about the ego, and that is that for myself, and I have discovered for most people, at least everybody I've talked to, the ego puts up blocks against the things that are absolutely the best for you. Because the better you do, the less it is in control. It's always about a control thing with the ego. And so it puts up blocks, and it will tell you that the last thing you want to do is this or that. For example, when you're angry with someone, the ego will say, the last thing you want to do is apologize. Or if you're feeling tired or irritable, the ego will say, oh, the last thing I want to do or you want to do is go work out. In both cases, and in every case, when the ego says don't do it, go do it. Quick, run. I found that the ego absolutely will build up this case as to why I should not do something. And the strong, you know, Victor Hugo, the author of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, said that strong and bitter words indicate a weak argument. And the ego is the king or queen of strong and bitter words. So consider giving your ego a funny voice like Bart Simpson, or sometimes I use foghorn, leghorn, whatever it is, anything that can disassociate you from the ego. That's what Eckhart Tolle recommends we do, is to disassociate, to realize that it is just that monster inside of our head that we can ultimately befriend, but first we have to identify it as not us. We have to know that it is not us. And we can do it with practice. Just takes practice. That's one of the key things that I've discovered about happy people. It's an ongoing practice. Just like you never get in good enough shape such that you stop going to the gym, if that's your goal, you continue. Happy people not only reach a certain level of happiness, and happiness can be achieved in ever higher levels, but they do it daily. They make choices daily. They watch that level daily. They never mind that ego mind. So get to work on your ego mind. Challenge it. Consider picking up Lisa Firestone's book. I highly recommend it. And thank you very much for being here with me this week. It's been a lot of fun as always. Thank you to Dan Murphy for being our announcer. And I invite you to connect with me on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/WillBowen, Twitter at WR Bowen. And you can also reach me via email, will@willbowen.com. Check out my website, willbowen.com. Have a great day. And you know what? Do something nice for somebody else before you go to bed tonight. It'll make you much happier. Enjoy the day now. Bye-bye. When you're happy like a